KMO Show, episode number 28, with guest David Roman, Tuesday, January 7th, 2025.
Well, let's just launch into it. And I will say that you are listening to the KMO Show. I'm your host, KMO, and I'm speaking with fellow Substacker David Roman, who is right now in Spain, but fresh back from China. David, it's good to talk to you.
Likewise.
So tell me about your trip to China.
Well, it was a family trip. I used to live there. I was a correspondent for a while in China. Then I married a Chinese woman. So I've been going back and forth to China because of, my work as a journalist and, because of family visits for about... it's 27 years now. Yeah.
So you have gotten periodic firsthand views of the progress and changes taking place in China.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Firsthand, when I arrived there, things were so different from the way they are now. The whole country has changed so very much. Well, it makes sense. It's been 27 years, but to be honest, Europe hasn't changed that much. It's something that I often discuss with my European friends. I was born here in Spain, then I lived in Australia. I've lived in a lot of countries, and I've talked to a lot of people from many places. And, the U.S. has changed a lot. Many countries have changed. China did. But, Europe hasn't. And for us Europeans, it is shocking how much China has changed.
Well, I have never been to China except a layover in Taipei, which is technically China, but,
don't go there. Yeah.
Yeah, right. it is. I mean, my interests are largely in artificial intelligence and robotics, and China is charging ahead in that area. Elon Musk has been developing his Tesla bot, but from... the videos I'm seeing on YouTube, at least, the Chinese companies seem to have leapfrogged past Tesla in terms of the agility and just the general, dexterousness and competence of their robots. So it's pretty impressive.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's hard to tell. When it comes to China, it's always hard to tell, how much is just hype, especially government hype. They love. You see these videos in social media about these fancy, well-lit, modernistic cities like Shanghai and Chongqing. And they have all of these, high-tech stuff and big screens and everything looks very fancy. On the ground, it's not quite that funky, really. China is still a country, still a developing country in many senses. So you have these futuristic landscapes sometimes, but you also have, things which are definitely, 1970s yet, bad roads, sidewalks full of cracks, people still carrying things around in bicycles in many parts of the country. There's a little bit of everything. But to be honest, it does feel like when it comes to the very cutting edge, in many senses, like you said, in robotics, in electric cars, in high-speed trains, in even space race, China is very much on the cutting edge, really. It's very far advanced. In other things, not so much. So it's a country that has, we journalists like to say, it's full of contrasts.
Yeah. There's a YouTube channel that's several years old now, but it started with a couple of guys, one American and one South African, who were living in China. And they would mount GoPros on their motorcycle helmets and just drive all around China and going to some places that the Chinese government wasn't particularly anxious to have them broadcast to the world. Some of the, still backwater places, places that are undeveloped, and also areas of new construction which are as yet uninhabited and already decaying. Are you familiar with that channel?
No, I'm not.
Well, when they started it, they were living in China. And they're both married to Chinese women, but the Chinese government let them know that they are unwelcome. So now they do their show about China from Los Angeles.
Yeah, it happens. It's tricky. And, I've heard a lot of different stories. like this. And you know, it's really depressing when you are doing a show which is like these guys. I don't know their example, but it sounds like it's the kind of thing that happens to you when you are, you know, a bit too edgy for the government tastes. And, and to be honest, normally they don't care so much about journalists, about foreigners, really, saying whatever they want for a foreign audience. But I would suspect that they probably caught some attention in China within, you know, Chinese audiences. And that is the thing that the government doesn't like at all. So if you are, you know, telling things about China to foreigners and, you know, it doesn't really head back to China in any way, they're fine with it. But the moment Chinese start paying attention to you and they go like, look what these foreigners are saying about China, that's that may be really tricky.
Yeah, I got that impression watching their channel.
Yeah.
Well, you are a fellow Substacker and your beat is world history. And mm-hmm. I've been reading through your posts, and I can. There are a few periods where I could probably have an informed conversation with you, but not many. Yeah, I am impressed with the breadth of your knowledge.
Well, it's my thing, you know. I've been preparing this project like for about 30 years now. I always loved history. I became a journalist because, you know, to be honest, I was like writing, you know. History, literature, but I thought, you know, when I was like, I don't know, 18, I was thinking, I don't know anything about anything. So I could be writing books. Lots of people do, and doing like some sort of a literary or historical career. And, but I don't know anything. So whatever I write, it's going to be, you know, misinformed. So I decided to become a journalist and learn things about the world, right? I was like the news, and there's this great, you know, the late Christopher Hitchens, he had this great sentence that he said that he became a journalist because he wanted to know the news, right? He didn't want to read the news. He wanted to learn the news first, just to know whether the news he was getting were true. And I had the same feeling, really, you know, before Christopher Hitchens actually, you know, spelled it out for me. I was always throughout all this time when I was a correspondent for, you know, the Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg News, or media. Throughout this time, I was always reading lots of books about history. I always approach things from an historical perspective, right? So for my editors, that was a bit of a pain in the ass sometimes when I try to, you know, you are supposed to be writing a story about, I don't know, inflation in Malaysia, and you go, well, you know, in the time of the Sultanate, and they go, oh, come on, get it out. Forget about the Sultanate. We want to know about CPI in Malaysia. Come on. don't try and be too smart. So, yeah, I had to. But I was always interested. Say I was a correspondent in Singapore and Southeast Asia for a long time. And I took that time to. So when I was meeting policymakers and, I don't know, diplomats and officials, I always asked them about the history and, you know, the important, you know, the important historical points for their countries, like independence from the British Empire, how that felt, and this crisis and this other pivotal moment. And I was always interested, you know, beyond my immediate needs as a journalist. And I think in the end, that's helped me a lot in my current incarnation as a historian.
How long have you been on Substack?
About 3 years now.
Ah, so a pioneer.
Yeah. Started very early when I read about it. First, I thought this is for me. Yeah, this is going to work out for me because I have all of this material. I have to find some way to let people know about this. Yeah.
Well, I got kicked off of Facebook in, I think it was 2017. And I had a community there that, you know, I was the administrator of. It was devoted to my previous podcast, the C-Realm podcast. And somebody didn't like an opinion that I expressed about Star Trek, and they reported me to Facebook as an impersonator. And
about
Facebook,
Star Trek?
Yeah.
Come on, what opinion did you have about Star Trek that people would object to?
That I didn't much care for the direction of recent Star Trek projects, and that I preferred the older Star Trek.
It's a crazy world.
Yes. So anyway, I got booted, and... It's an experience in, I don't know if it's Kafka-esque or Orwellian, but, you know, with the push of a button, they delete your entire history on Facebook. Yeah. So I'd been on it for about 10 years, and I had thousands of posts, and, you know, I was a moderator in a group with a couple thousand members, and suddenly all presence of my history on Facebook is gone.
Yeah.
I tried to get into Twitter, and I just don't really like the format, and I never really, I didn't engage with it enough to get any traction. So Twitter never went anywhere for me. And for years, there just nothing replaced Facebook, which was fine. You know, it was a time suck. But now Substack is, it seems to have finally, you know, filled that hole that Facebook left.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I think people underrate how revolutionary Substack is, to be honest. Even people like you and me, we are creators in the platform, and we write a lot and do a lot of things. We really underrate what sort of a difference it makes for us as creators, because every other platform sucks. It's not just Facebook, you know.
Yeah.
YouTube is awful. It's like it's been run by the devil himself. Yes, it is indeed. So bad, like the way that they monetize, you know, successful videos, because you know there's like 2 seconds of a song which is copyrighted, or because you know you're saying a word that they don't like, or they will use any excuse. Like I have this massive folder with about 100 plus videos, family videos that I used to. This folder was a private folder that I shared with my family members, right? With my mom, because you know, I'm always overseas, right? So my family could see videos of my kids, you know, in Washington D.C. or in Singapore, or in China, right? And my mother can see her grandkids doing, you know, stupid stuff, and I could send her the link so she can see it on YouTube. So I had well over 100 videos for about 10 years, and they just deleted it one day just because I had images of minors in, you know, half-naked minors. Like, you know, my kids who were like 3, 4, right, like crapping in the bathroom or swimming in the swimming pool. So it was pederasty for YouTube. So they deleted everything, and I had no recourse. I couldn't complain. I couldn't do anything at all. At least I had copies of all those videos, but it's really hard now because, you know, that really big videos, like it's really hard to share a 2 gigabyte video with a 70 plus year old woman, right? It's not easy. So that kind of thing happens a lot to a lot of people for these stupid reasons. I've met a lot of YouTube creators and Twitter is the same. Even under Elon Musk, it's the same thing. So it's really hard to find a platform that is just not, well, terribly run.
I have about 800 plus videos on YouTube, and they're mostly just me talking into the camera. And those videos are still up for the most part, but I've just withdrawn my participation from YouTube because every time I would get close to the threshold for them to make a payment to me, you know, for the ads, they would demonetize my account. They would find something objectionable that I had said, and said that I had violated the community standards. Yeah.
Yeah. And eventually,
I wasn't there to make money. That wasn't the point. But that sort of practice is just so distasteful. I just, you know.
Come on, money's nice. Yeah. We all like making money, even if it's 50, 50 bucks. Come on. They do. I mean, they're obsessed with their margins. Like they act like we don't care about the money, and they're obsessed with the money. Like they live and die for like extracting 0.1% out of you, right? And then they take your money like it's nothing. Yeah, that's very common among these companies, and you know they're really heartless, and it's best not to engage with them at all if you can avoid it, because you are giving them, not only you're giving them content for free in the end, you're giving them also content that they can use to train their AI models now, right? So they're not paying you, and they're actually getting a service out of you, right? And you're not seeing a dime. It is pretty crazy.
Yeah. Well, let's turn to happier talk. The most recent guest on this podcast was the Feral Historian, who's doing quite well on YouTube, I have to say. And, you know, he is somebody who his primary interest is history, but he also loves science fiction. And I think that you fall into that category as well.
Yeah, I do.
So tell me about your history with science fiction.
Well, I've always, you know, I was the, you know, very bookish, very, very bookish boy. I was really bad at all sports until I grew up. And it turns out that, you know, basketball is good for tall people. And that was, very convenient for me. But before I grew up, you know, I was really bad at every sport. So I was only with books, and I read a lot of science fiction since I was very, very young. My father was a big fan of science fiction. He had a massive library, which I read almost entirely. And so he had all of the classics, right? Heinlein, Philip K. Dick, that generation. He had it all covered for me. So when I was in my 20s, it was when I started, you know, living the classics for the first time and, you know, trying new things. And did I like them very much? So I had like a 10-year divorce from science fiction, I would say. And then one day I came across Peter Watts' Blindsight. It's a novel that at one point Peter Watts, he put up for free in his website because it wasn't selling at all, right? So he said, well, I want people to read this novel. I don't care if I don't make any money because I think it's a good novel. And he put it up for free. I downloaded the PDF one day. I was browsing. Somebody probably told me about it. I read the novel, and this single novel just got me back in touch with the science fiction scene. I started buying books from other authors and started to discover, you know, the Greg Egan, you know, generation, Alastair Reynolds, Stephen Baxter, Chiang, all these guys. But it really, I'm really in debt with Peter Watts. I dislike Peter Watts intensely, personally. Every time I see an interview with him, I think it's the kind of person I dislike completely as a person, but as a writer, I think he's fantastic. And I recommend all of his novels. I think he's a fantastic novelist. And, you know, if he has, you know, kooky opinions and is... My impression, I've never met him in person, but my impression is that he's quite a dislikable person. But my impression is, I may be wrong. He may be very nice in person, but he comes across as not a very nice person in interviews as well. But his books are fantastic, and I really am in debt with him.
Well, I'm happy that I came late to Peter Watts because I listened to the audiobook of Blindsight, and it was after talking to people who just, you know, praised it. But I hadn't ever encountered it until after I had written my own book, which takes place in the Kuiper Belt. So I'm glad that I wasn't even subconsciously drawing on Peter Watts, but that I did then get to go and pick up the spare, as the bowlers would say.
Yeah, but I would say, you know, the thing is, I just read your book, you know, Fear and Loathing in the Kuiper Belt. I think that the future you present, it's as crazy as this may sound, because, you know, as you know, you wrote it, you know, it has like these AIs who essentially control the inner solar system and all. It sounds more feasible to me than what he presents in Blindsight. Blindsight is too crazy at points. It's like, this is not going to happen. Like these vampires, you know, genetically engineered vampires, you know. I mean, it's a great novel. I love it. But it's not really what I would call a likely blueprint for the future. I don't think the future is ever going to like look like this.
Well, Fear and Loathing in the Kuiper Belt. I have to say, you are the only person that I know of who purchased the book because they learned about it on Substack. I'm assuming you learned about it on Substack.
I did. Yes, I did.
Okay, good, good. It is not selling, but largely just through laziness, I'm not going to put it up on a website for free. I'm just going to let it linger there on Amazon. And in the fullness of time, I would really like to produce an audiobook with a human narrator. I think it needs a woman narrator.
Yeah, probably.
But in all likelihood, it'll be an AI narrator. Audible will create an AI narrated version of your book for free and put it up on, you know, on Audible. But so far, the AI can't do different voices for different characters, and I'm waiting for that.
Mm. Yeah, good point. Yeah, I mean, I'm not very fond of audiobooks in general. So I've read some this way, listened to them, but as a rule, it's not something that I'm very concerned about because I just don't use the format very much. But I know lots of people do. So it's helpful to, you know, to cater to their test, definitely. And it, you know, being, you know, a novel could work better like this. Yeah.
I take a lot of very long walks with my dog and I listen to a lot of Substack posts that are AI narrated. And I also listen to a lot of audiobooks, and some audiobooks, I mean, the narration from professional actors is just so good that while I mean, my history with science fiction is mostly on the page, but in the last few years, I've listened to a lot more books than I've read. And I find that after some time has passed, I can't really remember what books I read on the page and what books I listened to as audiobooks. So the content, at least in memory, I think is the same, although it's very easy to tune out while listening to an audiobook and miss something crucial. And I often find myself rewinding and trying to rewinding. There's an archaic phrase, but you know, going back and trying to pick up something that I missed, because I'll ask myself, wait, what happened? Who is this? What are they talking about? So that's one frustration of audiobooks. And another frustration is, and I know this is a bad habit, I could easily stop it by not having the phone within reach of my bed. But if I wake up at 2 or 3 in the morning and I can't go back to sleep, I'll turn on the audiobook that I'm listening to. And there's a sleep timer, you know, on the Audible player and also on the Hoopla player, which is it's like Audible. I mean, the interface is just like Audible, but it is you get books through libraries. Mm-hmm. And so it's free. At least it's free for you, the listener. The library actually has to pay the, you know, the publisher for the right for you to listen to the book, which I think is a great situation.
It is a great model. Yeah.
Yeah. But I'll hit like the 15-minute sleep timer, and I end up like, you know, I'll still be awake when it turns off, and I'll shake the phone and start it up again, and I'll go 2 or 3 hours in the middle of the night listening to an audiobook, which is unhappy the next day, you know, when I'm very tired.
Yeah.
But science fiction, you recently wrote a Substack post that it was about generational ships. And there have been a great many novels about generation ships, which I haven't read, because I think the only one that you mentioned that I'd actually read was the Kim Stanley Robinson one, Aurora.
Aurora, yeah.
Yeah. But let me just, I'm going to mute my microphone and let you talk at length about the concept of the generational ship.
Yeah, well, it's probably my favorite subgenre within science fiction. I've always been intrigued about this concept because I think it's pretty realistic that, you know, pretty soon, say within the next 100 years or so, there will be somebody crazy that wants, you know, Elon Musk spaceship is working properly, somebody will build a bigger spaceship, and then somebody will say, why don't we put 2 or 3 of these together and try a massive trip all the way to, I don't know, Tau Ceti or Barnard Star or whatever, and try and see what's over there. And you will find 50 crazy volunteers, and they will all go together, and they will have kids along the way. And that's, you know, the concept of the generation ship, that you have a very, very long trip, you know, well below the you know, speed of light, and it's going to take a long time to get to the even the closest star. So it's going to be several generations living and dying within this ship. So the idea is that it has to be big enough, it has to have a system where you can plant crops and regenerate you know, breathing air and get water and, you know, be protected from radiation and find a way to generate gravity, because otherwise it's going to be, you know, everyone's going to be very sick at the end of the trip, or at least, you know, unable to colonize a planet. So the whole concept is that you have this long-term trip in which you have people who start the trip, and their descendants, with any luck, will be the ones who finish the trip. I think this is going to happen. Is it going to ever succeed? I'm not sure, right? It's possible that all of the generation trips that we try fail. It's possible that some succeed. It's possible that in the end they will find some other way to traverse, you know, the stars in some different way, like people will travel, will be frozen or asleep or transported in as AIs or within robots or who knows. But the generation ship is a very, very old concept in science fiction. In my piece, I discuss the very first generation, strictly speaking, the very first generation ship novel, which was published in the 50s. And then there's been a lot of them. And they all always have this concept that from the very beginning, I mean, there was never a golden era of the generation shipping, which people said, well, it's going to be great and we're going to colonize the whole universe with this thing. They are always negative stories in the sense that they are realistic. They're pessimistic, right? They are looking, all of these things can happen. And lots of things can happen. Just imagine any trip along the way. If you look at the history of human colonization of the planet, like even if you had to go to spend 1 year traveling from, say, the UK to Australia to establish the first settlements over there, 1 year is a long time. So 200 years, 500 years. So what happens is that lots of these stories are about people forgetting that they're even in a generation ship, or fighting with each other, killing each other, or developing crazy religions about how they are trapped in this netherworld. So there are also all sorts of approaches. So what I did is I picked several novels which I read that I thought were most most symbolic of the genre in the sense of they provide several viewpoints about it, people who forget about the destination, people who develop different castes within their different groups within the generation ship, and it becomes divided. People who go just, downright crazy. People who escape Earth, and then they fight each other, and then they divide into several groups. People who are clones, like I love this one, Noumenon. This novel is so very crazy. I mean, it's not a great novel by any, but it has so many crazy ideas. Just imagine the notion of just cloning some of the brightest and the most, like, you have a look at the planet, right? And you go like, who are the best people for a, long-term trip, throughout the stars? We're going to make clones of them, right? And when they die, we're going to get another clone. So it's going to be always the same people being cloned and recloned forever. It's just a crazy concept. I would have never thought of that. I mean, it's the least practical idea you can have, right? You can imagine that the very same person that starts a trip in Earth, say, year 2100, is going to be the ideal person to be in the planet in that ship 1,000 years later. It's a pretty crazy concept. And so we in the end, what we have is that I found reading all of these novels, what I found is that generation ship novels also give you a pretty good summary, pretty good impression of how the field is now. Science fiction, the overall, just not just this specific subgenre, but science fiction as a whole. You can see the dominant obsessions, the dominant approaches, the way most writers are looking at societies and how the future is going to look like. And it's not a very positive, impression that you get. You get the impression that a lot of these guys are, self-censoring themselves. Are trying to convey and present ideas that are socially acceptable as of 2024, 2025, or even 2020, right? Some of these guys seem to be stuck in the summer of Floyd, or in the wokest possible point in human history, and it is really disappointing. Kim Stanley Robinson, for example, it's a great example of this. I mean, he's such an enforcer of the current thing. It is really infuriating very often. You read his novels, it's like the guy is asking friends in Davos to look over the manuscripts, right? And it really is to me a melancholy reflection, because I've started reading the classics when I was very young because of my father. So I've seen the whole arc of the development in science fiction. And these guys very in the 60s and the 70s, they were pretty free. They were pretty crazy. They had their own ideas and people would let them rip. Just Philip K. Dick, yes, he was. He was a guy with no system. He could come up with these insane ideas and he would just publish them. And if people wanted to read them, fine. And they didn't, fuck them. This approach has gone away from science fiction. And I think it's pretty sad.
Well, as a teenager, I went through a Philip K. Dick phase where I read all of his books that I could get my hands on. And I noticed that he had a formula that he you know, a story structure that he enacted again and again. And then much later in life, I read some biography about him. And he was basically trapped in a system where he was working in a record store, or he had a number of different day jobs, one of which was a record store. But he would work all day, and then he would take amphetamines to stay up and write all night. And he ruined his health and, you know, one might argue his sanity in the process. But he was always living off the advance from his last novel, and his books never sold enough that he had got any residuals. So he always had to take another advance, and, you know, he was just churning the novels out for a period. And so, yeah, he would write the same story again and again, but because he was such a, he did a lot of acid, you know, a lot of other drugs as well. Yeah. And he was, you know, a scholar of, an amateur scholar, I guess I would say, of religion and history, but he always had something new to plug into the formula.
Yeah, he was an artist.
Absolutely.
That's the impression you always get with him. It's not that his craft was perfect. He was a great writer in the sense of, you know, the craft. Like, he wasn't a great stylist. You wouldn't grab one of his books and, you know, go teach a course in literature and say, yeah, try and write like Philip K. Dick. No. But, you know, his mind was very fertile, and he found a way to express this on the page. Not always in the best possible way, but he found a way to make it come across. And he was so free. Yeah, he was like, you know, I have this idea, and it may be a crazy idea. Maybe you don't like it, but I'm going to, like you say, I'm going to expand over it in three books, right? And then I keep going over the same subject. Like, you, if you read, you know, his most famous novels, like the Electric Sheep novel that inspired Blade Runner, for example, right? It's a pretty crazy novel. Like, the movie had to be toned down, and it happens with a lot of his novels. And I think that's missing now. I think that people, writers now, so they get published, so they get the prizes, so they get the advances, they have to be much more careful, and they have to be very mindful of how people are going to interpret certain things. They don't want to go into certain subjects, and they want to have certain approaches. And one thing that I noticed, for example, which is all over my piece in Substack, is how everyone has found a way to have a female lead, which is not actually a woman, which is a man in disguise, right? In your novel and in Fear and Loathing in the Cooper Vault, you have a woman as the captain of the ship, and several women protagonists as well as men. But this woman is a woman, right? You see, that's one of the strongest points of the book. You can see that this is a lady acting as a lady, as a woman, because, you know, it's 2025. All of us had teachers who were women, bosses who were women, right? I've worked in several corporations where most or all of my bosses were women. So you can tell how this has an effect on human relations. It's not the same thing to work in a place where everyone is a man. There's completely different approaches, completely different ways to relate to each other as when you have women in charge, because women have different approaches to things, sometimes better, sometimes worse. But they're fundamentally different from men in many ways. And what lots of writers now they do is, I have this story, and I have this guy who was John, and he's going to be the hero of the story, but it's not going to sell as John. People will like it better if it's Joanna. So I'm going to write exactly the same character. This was like this superhero, strong, independent man who ran the ship. No, it's going to be a woman, but it's the same thing, right? It's Joanna instead of John. It's Roberta instead of Robert. And in the end, you have all of these interchangeable women who are all strong, who are like all powerful, who are like smarter than anyone, who take shit from no one. And they're not feminine at all in any sense. They don't act like any woman I've ever worked with. None of them, right? They have nothing to do with real actual women. They're just, you know, men in disguise, because, you know, you have to have a woman leading the story. And I think that's pretty sad. It's pretty sad that people, first of all, they can't write an actual woman as a character, and second of all, they feel forced to have a woman running things because, you know, it's the way it has to be now.
Yes, and I think that science fiction is dying, not necessarily as exclusively the result of that, but just in terms of sales, The sad truth is that, you know, far more women read books than men read books. I work in a library. I see who comes and checks out books, and it's mostly women reading books.
Yeah.
And so publishing houses cater to women, but it becomes a sort of positive feedback where, you know, the more that the industry panders to the woman reader, the more men are driven away into video games and TV and sports and whatever else. But even male science fiction writers who are successful in the field and have been for a while, and you would think they could write whatever they want, they also, you know, they bend themselves to the contemporary fashions. There's an author whose books I like. His name is M.R. Carey. And I think mm-hmm. he's best known because one of his books, The Girl with All the Gifts, got made into a movie. Mm-hmm. But he's got a science fiction, I think it's a trilogy, or maybe it's just two books. But it's a multiverse story. It's called The Pandemonium, and there's lots of parallel Earths. And the premise is, look, the stars are just too far away. Space travel just never worked out. But then this one person discovered a way to move between parallel Earths, and then she discovered that there are whole civilizations that are pan-dimensional civilizations, and one of them is called the Pandemonium. Mm-hmm. Of course, the one unique aspect of this story is that, you know, you're sampling different Earths, and in different Earths, different species evolved to be the dominant, you know, technological species, and so most of the characters are not human. But of the worlds where there are human characters, the only named character who is a white man in all of the books is the most vile, disgusting person imaginable. He is a white man living in an alternate Earth version of Nigeria, and he is essentially a slaver.
Yeah,
and there are no other white men, you know, in the multiverse that are worth naming who aren't just scumbags.
Yeah. Yeah.
And M.R. Carey is a white man. I mean, there seems to be a self-loathing that one has to buy into in order to gain entry into this, you know, this dying genre of mainstream published science fiction. But fantasy dwarfs science fiction these days in terms of sales, which I read fantasy as a teenager, but I'm not attracted to it anymore. And particularly, you know, I've tried to read a couple modern fantasy novels and I don't get very far into them at all.
No, it was never my thing, and I think fantasy is very exposed to this as well, because fantasy, as you know, it's almost always based on an idealized or mythical version of European Middle Ages, right? So you have some sort of European Middle Ages with knights and kings and aristocrats, and everyone is wearing helmets and armor, and they fight with swords on horses, right? And so this presentation, like it really is very tricky if you are trying to appeal to a woke publisher. So you have to really bend yourself over a lot. So you have to make sure that your knight is going to be trans, or your queen is going to be the most powerful and virtuous person ever, because, you know, it wasn't a, on the face of it, this wasn't a very egalitarian or idealistic world. It was very much driven by macho warriors fighting each other. And, you know, actual women did very, very badly on a battlefield when you have to fight with, you know, brute force, because most women, like 99% of women, are unable to fight, you know, head to head against a man, unless they are genetically modified, like, you know, your women warriors in your novel. So it really is a minefield. So it really forces fantasy forces people to be extra mindful of all of these difficulties.
Have you read Gene Wolfe's The Book of the New Sun?
I have, but I didn't go through it. I didn't finish it. I didn't like it very much. I just can't. You know, I'm too much of a historian. I just can't deal with fantasy very well because of these reasons, because I know how it was at the time. So whenever people start to stray too much from, you know, my actual knowledge of the period, not just in Europe, because, you know, the Middle Ages were a applied to the whole planet. You had similar versions of it in, you know, Islamic world, in China. I just find it unbelievable very often, just unbelievable. So it's hard for me, but it's probably my mistake. It's my defect because, you know, I'm too much involved with history. So I've heard good things about you all.
Well, the thing with the Book of the New Sun is that it reads as fantasy at first, but the longer you read, the more you realize this is a hard science fiction story set in the very, very far future.
Right.
And, you know, one of the things about the book is that you can't put a shovel in the ground without turning up some relic of some past civilization. But his books are very dense. And that one in particular is, it seems to be, you know, a lot of people are just put off by the vocabulary. It seems like it's filled with made up words, but it's not. His point, or one point of the novel or the series of novels, is that English is a huge language and we only use a tiny little piece of it, really. So, you know, all of these arcane, seemingly made up words are actual English words, which we just don't really use in daily life anymore.
Right.
But I absolutely love that series. And then he wrote another series called the Book of the Long Sun.
Mm-hmm.
And it also seems to be a sort of medieval fantasy story, but then you realize that the people are living, it's not a generation ship, but it's more like an O'Neill cylinder, mm-hmm. you know, a very large spin habitat.
Yeah, like the Ring World, right?
Yeah. Not as big as the Ring World.
But right, pretty, yeah, of course.
I don't remember the exact dimensions of the Ring World, but it's, you know, you could put least hundreds, if not thousands of Earths inside it. It's impossibly large.
Yeah. Oh. See, that was another good example of just crazy free, you know, classic science fiction. I remember that they had this system, like in the Ring World, you have all of these different space races living together, and the way they have to greet each other is by having sex. Like, I remember reading this as a teenager. I was like, this is pretty insane. This is absolutely insane. Like, you can imagine this now, in this supposedly super free enlightened times, like people who have sex with, I don't know, some sort of, like sentient dinosaur, which is something that happens a lot in Ringworld, apparently, if I remember correctly.
I think more in Ringworld Engineers, but we get it in both novels where there are so many different variations on not just humans, but other species as well.
Yeah.
And if you travel for a long time, you're going to encounter a lot of very alien civilizations. And just one of the universal practices for breaking the ice between different groups is to pick a member of each group and just point them to each other and say, okay, go at it.
Yeah. Yeah. Pretty insane. Yeah.
And the main character, particularly in the second novel where he spends a lot of time alone and he's just traveling through the Ring World, he can tell how well a group is doing based on the person that they send to have sex with him. If they send out their youngest, most attractive woman, it means they're desperate and they really want to curry his favor. And if they provide him with, you know, an older woman or one who's not so attractive, then he realizes that they're actually doing pretty well and they don't need anything from him and they're just being polite.
Yeah, that wouldn't work too well these days.
Oh, no. I don't know if Larry Niven is still writing science fiction. I mean, he must be very old at this point, but
he must be very old. Yeah, I remember reading Yuri Purnell's, his co-authors. He had a blog in the early 2000s, and he sounded pretty old by then, in the early 2000s. Like, he was like this, you know, old guy, like remembering, you know, the golden years when he met somebody in the 1950s, right? Like they really. Members of a different generation altogether.
Well, I'm looking at a thumbnail image of you, which is pretty small, but I'm going to guess that you are a member of my generational cohort, Gen X.
Yeah, I'm 51. Yeah.
Okay. So you're more to the middle of the Gen X pack. I was born in 68, so I'm, how old am I, 56? And I'm an early Gen Xer, but I definitely do identify with that generational archetype. I'll be posting something later today, talking about the great filter of the Fermi paradox and the adaptive cycle of the panarchists and the Strauss and Howe generational cohort theory. And, you know, a lot of people, and I'm one of them, I'm very skeptical that the generational theory has much predictive power. But I have to say that the generational archetypes really do seem to tap into something real. I definitely identify with my generation, Generation X.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's something that I've noticed over time, right? Because, you know, when you are very, very young, yeah, you just don't care too much about these things. But now I have teenage sons, and I can tell the difference. I can not only tell the difference between me and my sons, I can tell the difference between me, my sons, and the intermediate generations, right? The people who are now 30s, in their 30s. And they have different tastes, different approaches to things. So this would be, say, the millennials, right? So my kids are like, Gen Y, I don't even remember.
I think if your kids are teenagers, particularly if they're late teenagers, they're Generation Z or Zoomers.
They're mid teenagers. The oldest is 17 now, and the youngest is 14.
Well, then I'm not sure what they're calling the next generation. It might be Generation Alpha.
I don't know.
But, you don't get to pick. And Generation X didn't really stick until the Douglas Copeland novel, which was in 91, I think. I was in my early 20s by the time my generation got a name that stuck. Strauss and Howe tried to give it a different name, and their label didn't stick. Yeah. So we don't know what generation your sons will be called. But my sons, who are in their early 20s, they are definitely Zoomers, Generation Z.
Yeah. And also, I think, most of the writers we've been discussing before, the writers who are now writing generation ship novels and other science fiction novels, are members of this generation. Like all of these, since Stephen Baxter is probably slightly older, but people like Alastair Reynolds, he's in his 50s, Greg Egan, Peter Watts, all of these people are our generation. And, we all of us, these guys, I think you're American, Kay, right?
Yes, I am.
Peter Watts is Canadian. Stephen Baxter is British, Egan is Australian, but we all were born in what may be the last really huge cohort, right, that there was in all of these countries, right? And then fertility fell off a cliff. And so now society has changed a lot because of immigration, right? When you were born, the US was like 80% white. It's going to be like 50% white by the time you are retired, right? And it's the same all over Europe. And you can tell these writers are just not very mindful of that. they try, but I think it's an additional problem in science fiction that you try and being this anti-racist, and you don't stick it because lots of people, these writers, they come up. With futures in which everyone is essentially standard American, standard, Anglo-Saxon person, even if they have a funky name. And it's just not the way the world actually works. There's actual difference in when you are Asian American, when you are African American, and Indian Americans, right? And not to speak of the rest, like none of the novels that I discussed before, they contain any hint that China is a superpower, for example, right? So the future, most of the science fiction written in the last 30 years assumes that China will disappear from the map soon, right? There will be no Chinese bases on Mars or in the moon. There's barely any Chinese characters. There's 1,500 million, 1.5 billion Chinese people in the world right now, right? So they will be in space. There's nothing about the Chinese culture in specifically, like I wrote in my piece in this, Aurora, right, by Kim Stanley Robinson. There is no Chinese representatives in this trip. So they're going to settle this other solar system, and they took care to bring people from Mongolia. They didn't worry about having Chinese on the ship. This is pretty crazy, right? There's this massive, massive place, this massive vacuum that they have, most writers in science fiction right now. And I think it's pretty sad too, you know, being married to somebody of another race, from another country, from another continent. I notice that very often we're still very much, Eurocentric in the sense of thinking that the world is always going to be like it was when we were, in the 80s. And it's not like that. Things are going to be very different. And one way or another, the future will be different, whatever happens. And it will definitely not be just like an extension of California in space forever. And this is something that I'm pretty surprised about, that like I said, Noumenon in this generation ship, where the only clone which is Hispanic is a guy who's a gardener, right? I mean, this is pretty insane. They got this guy and they clone him and reclone him to be the gardener in the ship for generations. This is just mind-boggling.
Well, I will say a word of defense for Kim Stanley Robinson in that he, after Aurora, he wrote a book called Red Moon. And the, he wrote a book called Red Mars, and that was in reference to the color of the planet. But in Red Moon, it is a political and cultural description. The time to dominate, moon colonization.
Yeah, because in his Mars trilogy, there are no Asians at all. Like, the Asians, they never make it to Mars. It's all a bunch of Americans fighting each other forever because they're also immortal, right? So, well,
you mentioned not every place is California, and Kim Stanley Robinson is very much a Californian writer. A California trilogy.
So for him, Mars was another extension of California, right? So the Chinese were like engineers working on the background, right, trying not to bother anyone, right? So then he felt bad, and he said, well, I'm going to do a scary story about the evil communist Chinese are going to take over the moon unless we do it first, right?
There's... in The Expanse, I haven't read the novels, but I did watch the TV series, and there's a group of Mormons who, collect their funds and they build a generational ship, and they're going to go off and just start a Mormon world somewhere. And it doesn't happen because the ship gets commandeered. But I think it's quite plausible that a lot of interstellar, colony ships and generational ships would be crewed by people from a specific culture who want to propagate their culture. And who might be very selective about, who they have in their crew.
Of course. And that is something, again, that few, if any, writers of generation ships ever address. The whole, what happens if, we have this ethnic group on Earth that has survived for thousands and thousands of years, oppression, travel, diasporas, and they decide to set up a colony for people who are observant members of their ethnic religion. That never happens. Right? That never happens. There's never a Zoroastrian colony on Io, right? It never, ever happens. Like, whoever sets on a trip to the next, solar system, they have no religion, they have no ethnic allegiance, whatever, and they all speak perfect English. it's pretty fantastic if you think about it.
I'd like to offer, I'm not saying that you're wrong about that, but I would like to offer a notable counterexample. And it's a book that I don't think ever really sold much. I never hear anybody talking about it, but it's by Greg Bear, the author of Blood Music and Darwin's Radio and things like that. And it's called Strength of Stones. Mm-hmm. And it takes place on a world with mobile cities, and each city is devoted to like an esoteric sect of Christianity. And I was reminded of it when you said there are no Zoroastrian, colonies anywhere, because I don't remember the full list of different sort of esoteric, extinct in many cases, Christian sects have cities devoted to them in this, this novel. But there are many that, I had to look up. I'd never heard of them when I read it. And I read it in the 90s. So this is a pre-internet experience for me. It was looking something up was actually an effort, particularly because I was living in Japan at the time. And there weren't a lot of, there wasn't a handy local library where I could go and grab an encyclopedia. So looking things up used to be a challenge. I notice when I'm writing my own, I think about my writing process and I'm constantly stopping to look things up and I'm constantly stopping to, discuss with an AI, usually Perplexity. In the current story I'm writing, it takes place on Galtz, which is the place where all of the Colombian soldiers come from.
Yeah, the Irandians. Yeah.
And there's a character who, it's important to him to infiltrate a society of people who are, you know, cigar aficionados. So mm-hmm. he has to learn about smoking cigars. Well, I don't smoke cigars, and I'm certainly don't run in cigar aficionado circles. So I'm doing a lot of research about cigar etiquette and different types of tobacco and things like that. And I have to mm-hmm. present characters who are knowledgeable about these things. And I find that, you know, I'll do a search and I'll read articles and things, but then I can also ask the AI and, you know, have like Claude or ChatGPT like assume the persona of a knowledgeable cigar aficionado and have like little practice conversations. I don't use any of their text, you know, but I get a feel for the lingo and the way that it gets used. It's a writing process that would not have been possible 5 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think you're really good with AI. Not just I've read your pieces when you are having discussions with AI, you know, for your writing process. But I think your depiction in Final Loathing in the Cooper Belt of AI is the most realistic depiction I've seen of likely, you know, AI takeover of you know, Earth. And I was really, really intrigued by it. How did you think of that?
Okay, credit where credit is due. The powers, which are the super intelligence inside mm-hmm. the Dyson Sphere, I lifted that entirely from Charles Stross's novel Accelerando. He calls that force the vile offspring, and the powers.
And you call it the powers.
Yeah,
right?
It is a direct reference to Accelerando.
Right. I mean, I think it sounds so feasible and so realistic the way you present it, because you know they're essentially, you know how it works, like. There's the old saying that any sufficiently advanced technology will look like magic to us, right? And in the end, they look like magic to us. Like, that's the way you present it, right? There are these powers that people say, you know, they took over Earth, and now they run it, and we don't know why, and we don't know what the long-term plan is, we don't know what they intend to do, but, you know, they are there. And I think it's a really, really, really good approach. It's probably my favorite approach in science fiction to AI, together with the Sunflower Cycle. And now Peter Watts, you know, they have this chimp, which is a really, really stupid AI running the ship. And I also love that one. Yeah, I remember, you know, I use the Sunflower Cycle as a source of bedtime stories for my kids. My kids are older now, but I think I'm going to use it for some bedtime story. You know, your semi-shared concept of the powers. I'm gonna use it too for stories with my kids because it's really fascinating.
You just reminded me. I used to tell my kids bedtime stories, and they were insatiable. They wanted more, more, more. And so I would just pull whatever out of my head, you know, out of my memory. So one time, as a bedtime story, I told my sons the story basically of Apocalypse Now. And
that's pretty good. I love that.
On another night, my son asked me, "Oh, tell me more about Colonel Kurtz."
That's really good. That's really good. Yeah. It's really good. But I mean, it is a really, really intriguing. I mean, it is a really intriguing thing to consider. I mean, you have a world that is taken over by AI, but it doesn't mean the end of mankind. It just means, you know, just how things branch out, and you have, which is to be expected. You have many different kinds of humans out there at some point in the future, right? If we leave Earth, you know, there will be very different people evolving in many different ways, like the floaters you describe in your novel, right? And you have like sort of like in Expanse, you have the Martians, right? The people who are like these Spartan-like people who have been trying to, you know, to set up Mars as an habitable planet for generations. And you have people living on Earth, and then you have the powers. I think that's going to be the future of mankind. Not a California in every solar system. It's going to be very very different approaches, and you know, Mormons in space and Saracens in space and you know Wahhabis in space. Right, it's gonna be lots of different colonies, lots of different approaches, lots of different people, very often fighting, you know, the same conflicts that we have right now on Earth, only taking them out there, right? And you will have people who, you know, Armenians and Azerbaijanis, you know, coming across each other in Mars and, you know, fighting it out because they hate each other on Earth and they will hate each other there as well. Yeah, think of the U.S. I mean, people still identify themselves as Irish Americans, right?
I do.
most Irish Americans, actually, they're like 1/8 Irish, right? You know?
Oh, not me. I have my DNA sequenced. I'm okay, very Irish.
But it is a common thing that you keep some sort of not allegiance, but a sense of identification. It's healthy too, right? It's healthy if you're an Italian American as well, and you like your pizza and your pasta, and yeah, you don't speak any Italian, you barely know where Italy is on the map, but you feel this, especially not so much as an Italian, but you feel as an Italian American, right? And that's gonna happen. There will be, I don't know, American Martians, and they will like, you know, they will have Halloween, right? And people who are not American Martians, they won't celebrate Halloween on Mars.
Yeah.
It's going to happen.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
There's a YouTube channel that I've watched for a few years now. It's called Science Fiction and Futurism with Isaac Arthur. Mm-hmm. And a point that he makes frequently is that because interstellar travel times are so long, any human colony that gets established far from Earth, you know, around a different star, is going to take a very different developmental path. And if humans from Earth ever encounter them, you know, after a few thousand years, they will effectively be aliens. They will be so different from us, not just culturally, but biologically as well.
Yeah, we probably won't be able to breathe with them. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Or, you know, maybe even get along with them or communicate with them in any meaningful way. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's quite likely that, you know, humans will never encounter genuine extraterrestrials with a different, you know, biological origin. But we will, you know, provided we get off Earth and start establishing different human lines in different places, we will encounter aliens, but they will be our descendants.
And humans,
before that, the aliens will be AI.
And I think that's probably one of the reasons why, you know, all of these generation ship authors that I was describing before, they don't get too much into this subject, is that, it's another minefield in terms of political correctness and wokeness today. Like, if you describe a planet where you have a bunch of humans that, you know, develop differently and now they are smarter or less smart than other humans, right? Are you making a political point about, you know, today's different countries and different conflicts, right? You're really just making a point that it's going to happen, right? People are going to evolve in different ways. Say you may have people like you describe in your novel who are genetically modified, so they're stronger and they're better for combat, right? These guys who take over the gold colony. And others who are not. And it doesn't mean that they are better or they're worse, but they're not as good in combat. But it really is a minefield. And people are going to go, oh, are they superior? Now, are we saying some people are superior to others? Well, in the sense of, you know, being able to do combat better, yes. But there are also other senses. So you can easily see how that can be misconstrued as you're making a point about, you know, some people being better than others from specific things like in Noumenon, like Mexicans are so very good at gardening, right? So let's always have them gardening, right?
That's a trope of the generational ship, is that you have very little freedom to chart your own destiny because you or your ancestors were selected for a particular role on the ship. And particularly if people are being cloned, we need a gardener, and this genetic template is the best gardener. So guess what?
Yeah, that's your job. Super gardener forever. So it's you can see how it's tricky. And you can see how people, I mean, Stephen Baxter, Alistair Reynolds, all of these guys have been discussing, they're really smart people. And they've written very, very good science fiction novels. And I'm criticizing these books. And many of them are very entertaining. Like, they're very good. They're very well written. They have great ideas. So I don't think it's that they don't know this. I think it's that the context in the publishing industry and the context in society is such that they don't have the same sort of freedom to express themselves as Philip K. Dick had in the 70s. I think that is fundamentally the problem.
Yeah. It's an effect of cultural pressures and economic pressures, and the economic pressures, I really think that they're not destroying science fiction, because there's lots of people writing science fiction who have no hope of being published traditionally, but who will find a very small audience online, probably not big enough, you know, for it to be their main source of income. But there's plenty of science fiction being written. But I think the problem I have, and this is certainly true of my work, is that I am my own editor. And there's not a book in the world really that can't be made better with the under the skilled guidance of a talented and experienced editor. And Absolutely. So all of these people writing science fiction out in the wilderness, because their visions are not politically palatable, their books really could be better and should be better.
Yeah, absolutely. That's something that as a journalist, something that I really noticed. How everyone, I mean, you may think of yourself as the best writer ever in history. Everyone can really work with an editor and see his work improved. And editors really have a role in, and because of different reasons, editing is a lost art. Even for big time authors, editing is not the same sort of process it used to be. If you read about, say, Raymond Carver is a great example. You know, Raymond Carver, he was notorious because he had this, I think it was Gordon Gist. He had this editor who was very hands-on, and he essentially created, you know, Raymond Carver's books out of the raw material, right? So they were very different when Raymond Carver was writing them. And his editor, he created the style that Raymond Carver became famous of so you have a role that used to be key that now, because of different developments in the industry, is almost gone. And I publish books and I've had them edited, and I've noticed over time that this is really getting worse. Like my last book it's a book of philosophy, and it was edited by the publisher, and it wasn't badly edited, but I noticed that the process was less thorough that it would have been in a Wall Street Journal article. So I took more time, and my editor took more time for a 1,000-word story in the Wall Street Journal than we took in editing a book which is 100,000 words. And that's the way the industry is working now. And I mean, for self-publishing authors, yeah, of course, forget about it. Nobody's going to edit your work. But even if it's published by a press, by a publisher, it's not that simple. And that's an additional process, an additional problem that the standards are dropping, definitely.
What's your philosophical area of interest?
I became very, very interested in philosophy because my readings of what we might describe as a postmodern neo-Marxist writer, philosopher, Slavoj Žižek, the Slovenian. But I keep writing. I mean, I keep reading Žižek with pleasure. I mean, I love his work. But I've been reading a lot of the classics now. So for this book in particular, this is a comparative history of ancient Chinese and Western philosophy, right? So I did a lot of reading of Plato, Socrates, the Sophists, the early Christians, Augustine, and all the Chinese classics, Mencius, Confucius, the Taoists. I didn't read a lot of like the originals. I read a lot of histories of philosophy and extracts and originals, some of them, but not all of them, definitely. I mean, it's really hard to go through the whole production of, say, Mencius. But yeah, I've always loved philosophy as well, and I think in my approach when it comes to history, it's really entangled. I mean, I don't see them as fundamentally separate subjects. So when I write about the history of mankind, I write about not just the history of what people did. I like to write about the history of what people thought, right? How they saw things, and to understand that, you need the philosophy, because that's the philosophers are the ones giving you a window into how people perceived things, right? So if you read Augustine, you get an idea of how, you know, educated literate people in the late Roman Empire, they saw the world around them. And if you try and write that history without having a good grounding on Augustine writings, you are missing out on a big part of the history.
Well, it's funny in that my academic training was in philosophy, but philosophy is a big universe, and I was interested in the philosophy of mind and the philosophy of science, and that's what I specialized in. So as an undergrad, I read Plato and Aristotle and Thomas Aquinas and things of that nature. But once I got into grad school, I was mostly reading, you know, very modern works about the philosophy of mind with an emphasis on artificial intelligence. And this was in the 90s. So, you know, neural nets, like functional neural nets, that, like the ones we interact with all the time today, were still science fiction. But, you know, in Western philosophy, there's a big split between what's known as continental philosophy and analytic philosophy. And I was completely on the analytic side. And then I was in Japan, and I was going to come back and go to grad school. And I had my girlfriend just, you know, talk to an advisor and pick some classes for me. And my first semester in grad school, I, you know, without choosing it myself, I ended up in a Hegel seminar taught by a German professor. And I had no idea what was happening. Like,
you need to read Jack. I mean that's the beauty of Slavoj Žižek. A lot of people know him because of his political polemics. He writes, I don't know, he's still writing The Guardian, in the London Review books about, you know, Trump or Brexit, or that's not very relevant, not very important. I mean, his role in the modern world really is he's the best explainer and the best interpreter of, you know, continental philosophy. So if you wanna understand what Kant, Hegel, Kierkegaard were all about, he's the guy. And, you know, all the French crazes, he's the guy. He's the one who actually get them and he can explain them to you. And to me, that was really eye-opening. And it really something just like I was saying that Peter Watts brought me back to, you know, to science fiction, Slavoj Žižek brought me back to philosophy. Like, I had read, like, Nietzsche and Plato and, you know, Heidegger when I was a teenager, right? But Slavoj Žižek is really the guy who told me, you know, this is what it means. This is what these people are, this is the point they are trying to get across. And they are actually trying to make points, to get points made. It's not the just crazy verbiage that a lot of people think it is. So, yeah, there's a lot of interesting contemporary history, definitely.
So you're familiar with the notion of 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon?
Nope.
Oh, well, how about just 6 degrees of separation? Like,
yes,
any two people on the planet have a chain of associations that's no longer than six. I'm 1 degree of separation from Slavoj Žižek. A podcasting peer of mine and longtime friend, a guy named Doug Lane, he's interviewed Žižek many times. So
there you go. Yeah. Yeah, but that's the thing. Slavoj Žižek's books are fantastic. His podcasting, his conferences, you know, his speeches about, you know, why Biden is better than Trump, that's good. I mean, he's an insightful guy. It's not great. His books are great, right? It's like trying to, like, I think all of us authors, and I think you would say the same thing. I mean, if you want to get what's the best of you, the best things you produce, normally are the things you wrote, right? Because you put so much time and effort on your books, right? On your writing. Podcasting may be, you know, very valuable. It may be very profitable. It may be very insightful. And it's a very good way to reach audiences. But I don't think anyone's best work is in, you know, in talks. And it's the same thing with Žižek. Like, you can listen to several talks by Žižek and you go, oh, this guy is pretty smart. But it's nothing like reading his books. That's the actual real experience.
Which of his books would you recommend first and foremost?
Well, I would recommend Less Than Nothing, which is a fantastic Hegelian, massive tome on Hegelian interpretations. I would recommend the There's so many, really. Anything really? All of the books he wrote between, say, 2005 and 2015. I think that's probably all of their best, all of his best books, all of his best work. And Less Than Nothing, I think it was 2012. I'm thinking The Parallax View is fantastic as well. It's not very very famous, but it's a fantastic book. It's really good. And just like you were saying with Philip K. Dick, Slavoj Žižek tends to go back to the same points. Like, you know, Philip K. Dick does, right? Like, he wrote the same book three times. Žižek does the same thing. So very often you're going to find the very same anecdote, the very same idea expressed slightly differently in various books. My impression is that he gets his stories and his points across best in these two books, probably, Parallax View and Less Than Nothing.
You mentioned, you know, well, I brought it up, I guess, initially, that Philip K. Dick writes the same book again and again. He's mm-hmm. got three books which are considered to be a trilogy. Mm-hmm. What is it? The Divine Invasion, Transmigration of Timothy Archer, and Ubik. And mm-hmm. they don't share any characters in common. You know, they don't share the same setting. You know, what is it about them that makes them a trilogy? And it's basically, yeah, the same story told three times in, you know, at different points in his life. And the main character of every Philip K. Dick novel is Philip K. Dick, and he just gives them a different name. So
yeah.
in Ubik, not in Ubik, what's the book I'm thinking of? Radio Free Albemuth?
Yes, I remember that one, yeah.
There's a book where the main character's name is Horse Lover Fat. Which is just an absurd name. And the point is, yes, it's me. You know, I'm dropping all pretense. You know, the main character's name is not Rick Deckard. It's not Barney Mayerson. It's Horse Lover Fat. Although sometimes he'll even drop that and just, you know, either speak in the first person or call the character Philip K. Dick.
Which makes sense, really. It makes sense. It's yeah.
But he usually doesn't have any sort of like, metatextual pretense or anything like that. You know, he tells very straightforward stories with no irony to them. But, you know, toward the end of his career, he was like, yeah, I'm going to write the same story again, but here I'm going to admit it on the page that I'm revisiting these themes yet again with the same stock character, you know, archetypes.
Refreshing honesty, really. Yeah.
Well, we've been on this conversation for over an hour and a quarter, and I find that, files, once they go over that length, they tend to become unmanageable on my archaic equipment. So, David Roman, it has been an absolute pleasure. I will become smarter as I continue to read your Substack, and thank you very much.
Yeah, and I can say the same. I hope to keep reading your pieces, and I think you're doing really important work. I think people should know more about science fiction and about how science fiction can really, you know, illuminate our path to the future.
Amen to that. Well, that was David Roman, and I'm looking at his Substack now, A History of Mankind, and he describes it thusly: the entire history of mankind in regular installments, not just European stuff, but the history of all mankind, from the Americas to sub-Saharan Africa and Oceania. And looking at his recent posts, the most recent one is about his trip to China. Before that, from January 3rd, is a post called Mithridates, Crassus, and Spartacus. Before that, Pompey, Cicero, and Caesar. Before that, the best of 2024 in A History of Mankind. And before that, Sulla's Revolution. So he's seems to be back in Rome. But before that is the post that we talked a little bit about. It's called Christmas Special, A History of Generationships in Science Fiction. And we didn't really cover much from this post, and I had intended to, but, you know, podcast interviews often don't go where we expect them to. But if you are interested in science fiction, and in particular in the various portrayals of generationships in science fiction, then I would check out the Christmas Special, A History of Generationships in Science Fiction. Science Fiction is the History of the Imagined Future by David Roman. All right. Well, I'm focusing more on writing than podcasting these days. I'm happy to do a podcast. I'm always happy to do a podcast. But, you know, it's finding guests that is, I wouldn't even say the challenge, just the bother. I'm not bothering. But if you would like to talk to me for this podcast and you are versed in AI, space travel, robotics, anything having to do with the prospect for a Comarex future, let me know. We can talk. If you want to talk about politics, I'm happy to talk about that with you for your podcast. But the best way to get in touch with me is just to send me a note on Substack. But if you're not on Substack and you're hearing this, my email address is kmo@crealm.com. That's the letter C and then a dash and then realm.com. All right, I'm out. Stay well.